Good evening, everyone, and this is John Campbell welcoming you to Miracle Hour on BBS Radio. A warm welcome to all our listeners all over the world, and I hope the weather wherever you are is better than it is right here in England at the moment. We got gale winds and freezing cold weather, so it's a good time to be tucked up in bed and listening to the radio. As most of you know that listen to the radio show regularly, I've tended to have a real wide variety of guests on the show, and it's always a fantastic privilege to have guests come on and share their stories. And tonight's guest is a particularly wonderful moment for me because, as you know, the show Miracle Hour is really brought about by my finding A Course in Miracles in my life and becoming a very avid student of the course. And I have to say a very early student, but even in the short time that I've been studying this amazing spiritual work, miracles have been happening in my life all over the place. And before I actually introduce my guest tonight, I just also wanted to put a message out to a wonderful group of people over there in British Columbia, Canada, where at the moment the universe has decreed that my lovely wife and I are not supposed to be together in the physical plane, but we are certainly twin flames, and it's a very challenging time for us all. But I just wanted to greet my lovely wife Mary and our spiritual family over there, Sue, Virginia, and Brenda, and Teresa and Philip, and all Sue's family, and so many wonderful people who made my life a real joy while I was over there, and who are always in my heart. And really want them to know that even though we are apart physically, you're always in my heart, and I look forward to the time where we can get together again. So a very warm and loving welcome to all of you. Those of you who are familiar with A Course in Miracles will know that the basis of the whole course is Jesus' teachings, which he dictated to Helen Schuckman starting in 1965. And the basis of the whole course really is the practice, the practical application of forgiveness in our daily lives. And there are a number of sayings in the course which have come to be known as definitive statements of the course. And one of those which struck me especially pertinent with my guest for today was that the holiest of relationship is when an ancient hate becomes a present love. And it's amazing because my guest today, I believe that we have kind of created that miracle in our lives. And he's an amazing young man who probably 10 years ago, 11, 12 years ago, we were bitterly opposed to each other for various reasons, which is not really important, but it was all surrounding the love of our lives, or one of the loves of our lives, which is football. And I ended up actually starting a court action against him. And yeah, it's one of the things which I look back on and I realized I had to forgive myself mainly and everything I perceived that had been done. But I can say that today we're in a very different place, and it has been one of the miracles of doing this work. And I came across him again on Saturday, where I went to have a lovely afternoon watching my favorite sport, my favorite team, and he collared me to go on local radio there, so I kind of did a deal with him, and he's agreed to come and join me as my guest tonight. And it's with tremendous pleasure that I welcome Ian Hart to the program tonight. So it's great to have you there, Ian. Can you hear us all right?
I can hear you loud and clear, John. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you beautifully. And how is the weather, first of all, down in sunny old Worthing?
Well, it's not sunny Worthing. It's everything but we've had almost monsoon conditions today. But apparently the weather's going to be fine tomorrow. It's just today's weather has been the worst of the week, we're told. But what do the weathermen know?
Oh, well, they proved they didn't know too much a few years back when we had the storms. But anyway, it's pretty much the same as it is here. So, Ian, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I do. I feel really privileged, and I feel very humble, actually, us getting together in this way this evening, and I'm very grateful because you're very busy.
It's, you know, what's gone is gone, you know, and it's various things go on in you know, people's lives, and people chat to. I mean, one thing I had learned a long time ago, life is not a rehearsal. You only get one go at it, and if you did everything right, and we all make mistakes, but the most important thing, and I think it's something that you've done, you know, in your life, is the most important thing with mistakes is to accept them and to look at them and analyse them and try and sort of take a different path. Always a great saying, I heard Tony Benn say it, and it's very, very true. And I've had the privilege of giving out the certificates at our local senior school last November for the kids that took their exams last summer, which is quite ironic for me because I left the school just being with no qualifications. But one of the
things... Oh, you've got something in common there.
But one of the things that I said, well, I quoted Tony Benn because it's very important. Throughout your life, one of the things is to be treat people how you would like to be treated. But that's a simple thing. But another important thing is, in life, always be a road sign, not a weathercock. Know where you're going. Don't change with the wind. Know where you're going. I think the most important thing that I try to tell the kids, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, everybody's got a hook in life. Everybody's got a hook to hang their hat. The problem is some people don't find it, and some people spend their whole life trying to find it. But once you find it, I've been very lucky. Funeral directing came to me relatively young, in my blood with my great-granddad and my granddad. I found it at 23, and, you know, and it's people might think it macabre, but I find it is, apart from my family, it is the love of my life because it's a job I enjoy doing, it's rewarding, I meet a lot of interesting people, I'm a people person, and it has given me a completely different outlook on life.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I was intrigued and I was going to invite you to share with our listeners, Ian, was... Could you tell us a little bit about your younger life? And, because it's obviously a spiritual program. It's talking about spiritual matters. And if you could tell me a little bit about how it was when you grew up regarding spiritual concepts or religious concepts and how you actually got into the funeral directing business.
Well, religion is almost sort of Not hand in hand. I come from a very religious background. My parents are both Salvation Army people, I'd always had a religious upbringing. I can remember singing Onward Christian Soldiers in 1967 when I was 3 years old at the army with the band playing along, and Bible stories and outlook. And then we moved to the United Reformed Church. Nothing sinister. My parents were involved with a drama group at the Congregational Church, which became the United Reformed Church. And we moved over there, but they since moved back to Congregational, to the Salvation Army. But I'd always had a church background. I'm not saying that I got to 16 and sort of rebelled, because I do consider myself a Christian, and at times there have been times in my life when I make no apologies that I have prayed, because there's been sort of pushed into a corner when family have been ill, and you know, situations haven't been right. I have prayed, and you know, sometimes it's worked, sometimes it hasn't. But I believe it has worked all the way, because coming on to something that you and I have spoken about before with my job, and seeing so many people having tragic lives and sort of tragedy hitting them, I can't believe that this is the end of it. This is that, you know, if we have a youngster pass away, someone passes away in a road accident, someone has a very, you know, aggressive type of cancer and has a very painful death, and all their loved ones go through this pain and this heartache, I would think that there has to be something beyond that, because God and you know, and Jesus and we are told from the first day we pick a Bible up that God loves us all. God so loved the world that he gave his only son.
Yeah. And what was it like growing up up to the ages? You said, I think I heard you say that you rebelled at 16. I mean, did you feel that you were, even though you were having these beliefs passed on, if you like, because that's what generally happens, we take on board what our parents give us, you know, but was there any part of you that felt that you were, like, inclined to connect with Jesus but not take on everything else? Was there any kind of feeling of that with you?
Well, without being flippant, John, one of the reasons that I stayed at Shenley Road United Reformed Youth Club and the Sunday School was, one, we had a football team that I was basically manager, chairman, chief bottle washer of, and two, we had some very nice girls there, and we used to have regular discos. So that was one of the reasons why I still went to the church, because it was a social thing. I had my football, which I basically ran the team, and then we brought the youngsters on, and we basically had a team from 76 to 83. So, you know, even when I was 18, I was still running the youngsters. So that was a social thing. But I in that time, I obviously suffered bereavement through in sort of family. So I lost my granddad's mother when I was 15, which was one of the reasons that I probably left school at 15 with no qualifications. That she got ill in the January, and then basically I didn't go off the rails. But I was very angry. I didn't do as well in my class. I didn't do very well in my exams at all. And I just feel that you have to look back on things like that, and I probably went not rebelled, but I probably went to college after leaving school and met a different group of friends, and obviously while church was still there, it wasn't top of the agenda, i.e. going out to pubs and clubs and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very common thread amongst people, you know, certainly of our generation as well, my generation, which is probably the one after yours in a way.
I mean, what worries me now, John, with the youngsters now, and I've got a daughter of 15 and a son of 12, is that from when I was 16, 17, and going out to pubs and having sneaky pints of lager when I wasn't old enough, there's a lot more drugs around now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound like a preacher, but the devil has various forms, doesn't he? And is drug addiction one of those forms?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, I've thought a lot about this, you know, and whether you're aware or not, I don't know, but I've done a lot of research into this concept of the indigo children. You may have heard the term, you may not, but this is it's virtually an acknowledgement that there is a wave of young people coming to the world these days who have got some deep understanding and deep wisdom of what life is really all about, the fact that life is actually a classroom. And that really the important things are love and compassion and forgiveness and following your passion. You talked earlier very interestingly about, you know, many people, I think you put it beautifully, you said that, you know, everyone's got a hook to hang their hat on, but not everyone finds their hook. And I think that's absolutely so truly. And one of the things that I'm passionate about, and a lot of my work is around, is about trying to encourage a different way of preparing our children for adulthood. Because one of the things that dismayed me when I started to talk to hundreds of kids, you know, and they're in the sixth form or whatever, and I kept asking them the same question, you know, what's your passion? What are you passionate about? Love? What do you want to do with your life? And you know, 90% of them didn't know. And for me, that was really an indictment of our system. Because if we have a child in the system from the age of 4 to 18, and at the end of it, they don't have a clue what makes their heart sing, you know, I find that's one of the biggest tragedies about our system. And I think that we've got a group of...
Yeah, well, I was having this conversation today, John, with a friend of mine. Sorry, these dogs sing. And I was having this conversation with a friend of mine. I was having this conversation with someone today about my own son, about whether he would follow me into the business. And I'm 43 years old. I think I'm fairly streetwise, and I said that I would not mind whatever my children wanted to do, both either of them, whatever they wanted to do. If my son turned around and said he wanted to be a busman, providing he was happy and he was contented and he had enough money to look after his family and had enough money on a Friday to go home and care for his family and look after his family, I wouldn't care. If he was happy and contented, one of the most unhappy people I knew was the person who earned the most money. He worked in the City of London. He used to have to get up and get a 6:16. He didn't get home till 10 o'clock at night, and he was on a six-figure salary, and we're talking about 15, 20 years ago, but he was one of the most unhappy people I knew. So what does that tell you? Money doesn't buy you everything, does it?
Well, absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, that's a part I think so many of us find in our lives. And coming back to the Course in Miracles, I mean, what a Course in Miracles really teaches, the whole essence of its teaching is that all the time we're looking anywhere outside of ourselves in order to give us happiness, security, love or whatever, we're always going to be disappointed at the end. That sooner or later we're going to be disappointed. And the whole essence of the Course's teachings is that when we take our focus off what he calls the screen, you know, the screen of life, and put it back into the projector, which is our mind, and we get to clean up our mind, clean up our thoughts, understand that we're perfect, whole and complete, that we have an essence which is totally innocent and has never been guilty ever, then we change the way we feel about the world. And another definitive statement of the Course in Miracles is, seek not to change the world, seek only to change the way you view the world. And I found that's been such a help to me in my life. But it's like coming back to the kids. These kids kind of seem to know this. They've got a real wisdom about them. And I think I do think the traditional education system is totally outdated. And I think if they were to concentrate more on what is it that kids want to do, what is it that lights their fire and somehow make it possible for them to follow that, I think they'd take a lot of the angst out of what we're experiencing in the education field.
Yeah, without wishing to go into the realms of politics, this is where I feel in some ways I feel cheated by Tony Blair, because when he came to power, I had a young family. And we've had all those years of the Conservatives and Thatcher and John Major, and I felt here was a man. I mean, not so much Christ-like, because that would be blasphemous, and I would never do that. But here was a man that could have changed everything, John. Here was a man that could have reshaped the whole fabric of this country, moved us forward. He's tough on crime, tough on the cause of crime. Education, education, education. And it seems to me, John, that he got to the trough and realised that the water tastes nice and changed overnight.
Yeah, well, I think I just think that it's just like everyone's in the same. It's there is search. I mean, these are all false idols, aren't they? You know, Jesus talked about false idols.
You've got your book about Jesus coming back, and it does intrigue me. I mean, I think it's a great talking point. What would Jesus do if Jesus came back now, or he may be here, or already? If Jesus came back now, would he be on Sky News every week? You know, would he not do the Sermon on the Mount? Would it be at the interval of the X Factor? Would he be on ITV? Would he be a media star? Rather than the person who was the carpenter 2,000 years ago, because we're a media world, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We are, and I think that even the media.
And how would people view him? How would the Christians view him?
This is the interesting part, because he was crucified before, and of course, the fact is Jesus was a Jew. Most people are aware of that. And as the Course teaches, that he had no wish for any new religion to be built up in his name. But really, he was teaching the fact that none of the physical world is real, you know. And this is why he was crucified. You know, why they couldn't stand to listen to his teachings, because it's so challenging. And A Course in Miracles is one of the most challenging spiritual disciplines there is. And although it's very simple, it's an incredibly challenging, because the ego wants to keep us in the belief that we are our body and that this is real and that's real. And really, the Course's teachings, which I believe Jesus' teaching, was that nothing is real. And, you know, and it also talks about that he never did suffer, because he had so transcended his body, he was able to, with the power of connecting with the superconscious mind, that he was, able to not feel pain of any sort. And, you know, when I started to do some of the experiments, I totally get the possibility of that.
Yeah, I mean, people say, there's a great saying, isn't there, that the people have spoken. You know, when an election takes place, people say, well, the people have chosen, but the people have spoken. Well, let's remember, the general public chose the rabbit, didn't they, over Jesus? So they don't always get it right, do they?
I mean, yeah, and there's that lovely piece. I can't remember the exact words, but my wife Mary was, I think she emailed it to me. I must get hold of it. It's a piece where Jesus is talking about go through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and many will pass through to the place of pain and destruction, but the gate is narrow, and few will pass through to the gate to heaven, or something. And translated into today's language, I always like to think of it as saying that if you keep on following the herd, you'll end up stepping in doo-doo.
Yeah, well, it's true. If you follow the herd, John, you'll end up in Tesco, don't you, now?
But it
does amaze me that how he was, you know, how he would be viewed now. I mean, has he come back? You know, was he Malcolm X? Was he Martin Luther King?
Well,
was he John F. Kennedy?
Well, that's the other thing. And I mean, more and more people now, because it was interesting, I think I heard you say at the beginning about, you know, this life is not a rehearsal, we only get one shot at it. Well, I think I believe that not to be the case, and I think millions of others now. I read somewhere that 75% of the world's population now believes in a reincarnation, you know, and of course, this is what the Course is really talking about, is that this is a lesson. It's a lesson here, and the lesson is to get to know who you really are, which is pure spirit, pure love, and that you have never separated from God, never separated from Source. And until we actually reach that place, we appear to keep coming back for different experiences. And And I think that that's, that for me anyway, that's very clear. And, I've had personal experiences of connecting with family members, etc., in spirit. And I think once I actually had those experiences, that really deepened my understanding that, and the great thing was it took away the fear of death. I mean, you must have experienced, goodness knows how many deaths you must have experienced in your work. And I guess you experience all different types of reactions, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about fear of death. I had a lovely story a year or so ago where a friend, her father, had had a record number of chemotherapy sessions. And, it was obvious what was going to happen. And he had a dream on the Thursday night and woke up the next day and said to his wife, he said, I know where I'm going. So I went there, it was beautiful. I met my mother there, I met my father there, and I'm not afraid of dying. I'm ready to go. And the following night, he had another dream, and it was more specific, and he went into the sort of things that he'd said and how he was allowed in the garden, and the younger members of the family went with him to the gate, but they weren't allowed in. But his overriding theme was there was nothing to fear, nothing to fear, and he was ready to die, and he wasn't frightened, and he died within 24 hours.
Wow.
But his family really found that, his family found that to be really uplifting and almost a comfort that he had this dream. And he said, oh, but was it a dream? You know, did he go, when he went to sleep, did he go somewhere else? Was he lifted into another stream? People are listening to our radio station or your radio station now, John, but there are other radio stations. So, was he taken to another level and then made not to be frightened? Because people are frightened. People are frightened. I always think, people say that my job is hard as a funeral director. My job is rewarding. It has its difficult moments, but ultimately it's not a hard job in the sense that a nurse is, who is there with families as watching people die. I mean, I don't think I could watch somebody die.
I think that's an amazing story. And, yeah, I mean, that's a lovely analogy as well. I love that, the fact that here we are talking.
But there's something else, when my great-granny died, and this was in a two-up, two-down house in Bermondsey, which is in south-east London, for your colleagues around the globe, right in the middle of Docklands. And when she died in a house in 1935, 20 minutes before she died, she told them. She described that all the dead members of her family were standing around the bed, smiling, telling her it was time to come. And I really believe that there has to be something afterwards. And
yeah,
it has to be something good. Because
that's the whole point. And as you're talking, Ian, if you just pardon me for 1 minute, because it just popped into my mind, there's a lesson in A Course in Miracles, and as I think most of us know, that the Course in Miracles consists of a text, about 600 odd pages, and then 365 workbook lessons, one for every day of the year, which the student is encouraged to do on a daily basis. Just they only have to do it once, and it brought to my mind lesson 182. And I'm just going to read this little section here because it is so powerful. It says, and this is Jesus' dictation, dictated this to Helen Schuppen in 1965. And he says, I will be still an instant and go home. This world you seem to live on is not home to you. And somewhere in your mind you know that this is true. A memory of home keeps haunting you, as if there were a place that called you to return. Although you do not recognize the voice, nor what it is the voice reminds you of, yet still you feel an alien here, from somewhere all unknown. Nothing so definite that you could say with certainty you are an exile here. Just a persistent feeling, sometimes not more than a tiny throb, at other times hardly remembered, actively dismissed, but surely to return to mind again. No one but knows whereof we speak. Yet some try to put by their suffering in games they play to occupy their time and keep their sadness from them. Others will deny that they are sad and do not recognize their tears at all. Still others will maintain that what we speak of is illusion, not to be considered more than but a dream. Yet who, in simple honesty, without defensiveness and self-deception, would deny they understand the words we speak? We speak today for everyone who walks this world, for they are not at home. They go uncertainly about in endless search, seeking in darkness what they cannot find, not recognizing what it is they seek. A thousand homes they make, yet none contents their restless mind. They do not understand, they build in vain. The home they seek cannot be made by him. There is no substitute for heaven, and all we ever made was hell. And I think that's a beautiful piece that really, for me, describes our human life. Are you still there, Ian? Hello? Okay. Hello, Ian? Hi, Ian? Hi, Ian? Hello, Ian?
Hello, John.
Oh, hello, Ian. What happened there?
Hello.
I don't know, mate. I think it must have been the old satellite move, too. You were reading me lesson number 181.
182, yeah. Did you get that there?
What? No. You were just about to get it and went off.
Oh, okay. I'll just repeat that for you here, because it's a beautiful description I found, and it says, and this is Jesus' dictation, this world you seem to live in is not home to you, and somewhere in your mind you know that this is true. A memory of home keeps haunting you, as if there were a place that called you to return. Although you do not recognize the voice, nor what it is the voice reminds you of, yet still you feel an alien here, from somewhere all unknown. Nothing so definite that you could say with certainty you are an exile here. Just a persistent feeling, sometimes not more than a tiny throb, at other times hardly remembered, actively dismissed, but surely to return to mind again. No one but knows whereof we speak. Yet some try to put by their suffering in games they play to occupy their time and keep their sadness from them. Others will deny that they are sad and do not recognize their tears at all. Still others will maintain that what we speak of is illusion, not to be considered more than but a dream. Yet who, in simple honesty, without defensiveness and self-deception, would deny they understand the words we speak? We speak today for everyone who walks this world, for he is not at home. He goes uncertainly about in endless search, seeking in darkness what he cannot find, not recognizing what it is he seeks. A thousand homes he makes, yet none contents his restless mind. He does not understand, he builds in vain. The home he seeks cannot be made by him. There is no substitute for heaven. All he ever made was hell. And that is a small part of Lesson 182, but I find that piece there encapsulates exactly what I see, what human life seems to be about.
It's lovely words, John.
Yeah. And I think that's a lot about what this seeking is about, you know, unconsciously. And that's what I see happening. You know, we were talking earlier about what's happening in the world. I do think there's a shift in the world. I do think slowly but very surely people everywhere are waking up to the fact there must be something more than this. Just that those words there sing so much to people, you know. There must be something more than this. And who am I and what am I here for? That seems to be the question people are asking.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we do have to be very careful when you talk about these voices. This lady, and I'm gonna, when we meet up again, and we will meet up again at football, John, I want to borrow them. We'll have a look at these books and sort of borrow them and read them, because voices come in different ways, don't they? I think people across the Atlantic may not realise who Peter Sutcliffe is, but sadly Peter Sutcliffe is a very evil man. He was a mass murderer in the 70s and early 80s in England. And his defence was that he had voices from God while he was digging a grave, and he told him to do it. And you know, saying that almost blows the voices theory out of the water, but it shouldn't do. It's just him hiding behind something evil, and it goes back to what we said, Satan has many different forms.
Well, yeah, that's it. And I mean, what the calls would talk about, say, would be that any voice of God or Jesus would be a loving, compassionate, forgiving voice, would not be a condemning or murderous voice, would never give things like that. And I think my understanding is that's more the fear-based ego, sometimes called the devil, you know, and those are the kind of voices that's the constant battle between spirit and form. So I totally understand what you're saying and the fact that people have to be very careful. But for me, it's pretty cut and dried, is that, you know, the voice is the intuition. And, you know, a lot of people talk about intuition, and really what I think, I mean, intuition, what it means is inner teacher, the teacher within. You know, there is a teacher within that knows everything. But the problem is that most of our lives are spent so busy that we don't still ourselves enough. And I found that one of the things that when my life starts to go more simply is when I give myself dedicated time to be still. And I think that's one of the advantages of your work, is you probably get quite a bit of that in your work. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a very, very difficult thing that we had at the beginning. That's one of the why I remember sports, which, you know, I do apologise to our American colleagues and other people around the globe who might not necessarily know who Diana Thorne was, but she had, I think it's fair to say, John, she had a fairly checkered life, but she encompassed religion at the end of her life, or towards the end of her life, and specifically Catholicism. But she actually lost a child in the early 70s, but she actually didn't grieve for the child because she believed that she would one day meet that child, and it was was only temporary. It wouldn't be permanent. And I think that whilst grief had hit her, she actually turned it on its positive, because whilst the child wasn't right for this world, it would be in another world, and she would meet it one day.
Yeah. And who is this you're talking about here?
Hi, Ian.
So I think, I don't know if you've got a bad signal area there, but you keep cutting in and out. Who were you talking about, Ian? Who's the lady that you were talking about? Ian, I don't know if you're moving around there, but you're definitely cutting in and out. So we're having a few technical difficulties there, and it's interesting, but I don't know. I think Ian's probably coming back on there for a moment, but anyhow, he was talking about a lady, and I didn't quite catch who he was referring to. So we'll just see if he's coming back on there at the moment. But earlier, Ian was mentioning the fact that he got a lot of inspiration and comfort from doing the work he does and witnessing so many people, and that he started to find
he's
him asking. Okay. All right, Ian, you're back with us, sir.
I can hear you loud and clear now, John. It's marvellous.
I think you would probably maybe be moving around. So what I was saying, Ian, that the lady, who was the lady you were referring to there? I missed that. I didn't know if our listeners got that.
Diana Dawes.
Oh, Diana Dawes. Right, okay. Yeah,
Diana Dawes, the film star.
Yeah, that's right. Now, when did she pass? Refresh my memory. In the 60s? Mid-60s?
She passed in 1984. She died in April 1984.
Just after the Cup final.
25 years ago now.
Yeah, right. Just after the Cup final, huh?
Just after the Cup final, yes.
Yeah.
I hope they're going to invite you to this dinner, because just for the other listeners, our passion, our football team got to the Cup final 25 years ago and played Manchester United, and it's 25th anniversary this year, and they're having a dinner in honour, and they're getting all the team back to together. I hope they invite you, John.
Oh, that'll be fun, Ian, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that. You know, I
have a word for Mr. Boone.
Who's arranging that, then?
The football club are.
Oh, are they? Okay. But it's interesting, you know, I look back now, and I see so clearly how much of my passion, what my perceived passion within football and also in my business life, you know, was fueled by anger. Because it was very interesting, because you know how passionate I was and the lengths I went to stand by my beliefs, you know. However, when I went into the treatment center, the rehab, obviously there was no TV allowed, no radios allowed, you know, it was a very strict regime in order to keep you focused on within. But they did make an allowance, I'll never forget this, they made a special allowance for us to watch the England versus Italy game that year, it'll be 97, so you'll be able to refresh my memory, you're more up to whether that was a World Cup or a European.
October 97,
Italy away, didn't we win 2-0 or 1-0?
No, we do 0-0 and we qualified.
That's
and
right, we qualified.
Ian Wright could have scored.
That's right, we qualified.
Ian Wright, took it round the post and could have scored.
Yeah, and I remember watching that. They made a special concession. The council has made a special concession because they realised it was a big game. And the amazing thing was I remember sitting in the lecture hall watching it on the big TV that they brought in for it. And the first thing I recognised was I didn't have that desperate passion anymore. It wasn't there, you know. I was still enjoying it, and I was able to enjoy the football and all the rest of it. But that kind of passion that was there, and I think a lot of that was, you know, because I had to release so much anger, which I didn't even believe. I didn't believe I had, but it is amazing how that went after I'd done a lot of work in treatment. But it's still, you know, it's still a great passion. And I think it is a reflection of...
Can I ask you, John, what was your Damascus moment then? You know, Saul had his moment on the road to Damascus. What was your Damascus moment in your life?
Which really woke me up to a different way of thinking?
Yes.
Well, I think it was pain, Ian. It was physical, emotional, and mental pain. I got to a point where the alcohol, the anesthetic effect of the alcohol wasn't working anymore, whereas before I'd managed to anesthetize my sadness, my anger, all my emotions really with alcohol and football, you know, before. But then, as I said, when I left the football club, then I had that taken away, so therefore my alcohol intake increased. It's interesting. And I think that in the end, it was just pure pain. And the fact that the way I was living my life, I had become so far removed from who I really am, that I think that difference, that resistance, creates such a pain at all levels, emotional, physical, mental, and spiritual. I was spiritually bankrupt, and I was in so much pain, and that's what led me in. And then what happened was, which happens, I hear this in so many stories of people that make big change, an angel, a guardian angel, came into my life, a chap who I had known for many years. I hadn't seen him for about 15 years, but he knew I was involved with the Albion, with the football club. And because he hadn't got my number anymore, he actually phoned the club. And if you remember, the secretary at the time was Nigel and Diane. And Diane gave him my number after checking with me. And he phoned me up and he asked to meet me. And I hadn't seen this guy for 15 years. And as soon as I saw him, he looked fantastic, you know, and I thought, what's happened? And he told me his story about how he'd gone into this treatment center and how he changed his whole life. And of course, I wasn't at all interested at the time. I wasn't ready. But it sowed the seed. And then 2 or 3 years later, when my point of my rock bottom came, I heard a voice very clearly telling me to phone this guy, because I hadn't heard from him or seen him since. And I phoned him up after 3 years of not seeing him. And I just told him what was on my mind, that I thought I had a problem. And he laughed and he said, oh, John, he said, I knew you'd phone me. He said, I didn't know how long it would take, whether it was 6 months, 2 years or 3 years. He said, it's been 3 years, but it doesn't matter. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I could see it all over you, you know. I could see it. I could see the pain when I met you. And he said, here's a phone number. Just phone this number and it'll change your life. And that's exactly what happened to you. And you know, I took the phone number. And I came off the phone, and that was the first time I acknowledged the problem I had, and the compulsion and the craving for alcohol left me in that second, left me, and it has never returned. That's nearly 11 years, and I ended up going into the treatment, and that was my turnaround.
Well, that's good, and you know, and that's marvelous, but I don't think you're alone, are you? And the wonderful thing is when we met on Saturday, and it's great to see that you've still, and you've always had it, you've still got the love of your family, John. Your lovely daughter was there, and that means more, you know. What did it say in the scriptures? It's easier for a poor man to enter the kingdom of heaven.
A camel to pass through the eye of a needle.
For a rich man to enter the gates of heaven or something, isn't it? Yeah, but it's family, it's so important. Family is so important. And it's great that you know that we'll always have yours, and I'll always have mine because of the way that we live our lives. And it's sadly not everybody is like that. I mean, going back to what we said about society, you know, that's part of the problem is now is that we seem to have the fabric of society has changed, and we don't have, some of these kids don't have stable home environments, and it is a problem.
Yeah. Well, it is, and I think one of the things that both my wife, now my present wife, and I came to understand is that there are a lot of mismatched unions that happen. And often through, you know, choices being made when we're wounded, you know, when we're under the influence of drugs or whatever. And then, you know, there are things that go wrong and the family is completely dysfunctional. But there are a lot of people realizing now as well that there is a greater family than our own. You know, the whole world is a family as well, you know, that although obviously our priority is our unit, our family of origin, that there is a greater family out there that we are all actually joined. And I think the lessons that people are learning now is that we're, you know, underneath all the camouflages and the personas, that we're actually all the same. And there seems to be a joining of people. And And I think that's what we saw, you know, even in the political levels, what we saw in Germany when the Berlin Wall came down. That was the power of the human spirit. That, you know, that was people connecting with their birthright, which is freedom. You know, that's our basic birthright.
Well, but have you ever met a West German that was happy the wall came down, John? I've never met one.
I have met some, you know, and I know what you're saying, but, you know, I think they're getting to realize that as well, you know. I mean, it's all, to me, because, yeah. You know, it is, the whole thing about the Course in Miracles is geared to ending the illusion of separation. And I find it amusing, I really do, that there are all these so-called borders being encroached, because I think there's a greater message going on somehow, you know. And I think it's about when we get rid of fear and let go of control and we let people be free. There will be times of chaos, but eventually everyone will end up where they want to end up, and not everybody wants to be in the same place. So it's only sort of the powers that be, fears of these things, that creates them trying to control, and control never works here. It never works. And you see that in personal relationships, and you see it at the, you know, macrocosmic level of government. You know, I mean, how many laws did Tony Blair bring out? Something like 780 new laws on the statute book, and there's more crime and everything than there was before, because for every force you create an equal and opposite force. So, you know, it's a fascinating subject, and I think very much it's about, watch your space, there's more to come.
Yes, definitely.
So, the future for you, and you're continuing with your work in the media and the radio?
Yes, indeed, I'm going to continue doing the phone-in for another couple of years, continuing doing work and enjoying it, and just trying to sort of live my life, you know, just going in the right direction. As we said at the top of the hour, being a road sign, not a weathercock, looking after the family, which is important. You know, it's that's how we have to look at it. I think if you can have opinions, you can have, but just so long as you don't hurt anybody else. And by hurt, I mean really hurt. I mean, you can sometimes hurt people's feelings with your opinions. I do that every week on the phone. But I mean really hurt people. Just as long as you don't do that, and you live your, you know, you have a code of, almost a code of conduct, almost a, you know, a moral code. And I honestly think, I mean, before I came on air, I had to go down to the shop and buy my wife something and bring it back to me. And there was a child there playing up. This kid was 10, 11 years old. So he wasn't a small kid. He was 10, 11 years old. I mean, you know, going back 100 years, he'd have been working down the lines at his age. And the way he spoke to his mother and behaved with, you know, in front of his mother, it was disrespectful to his mother. And I just wonder, you know, what future has that kid got if that's how he's behaving at 11?
Where's he learning it?
If the mother does what she should do and click him around the ear, she'll have all the doom good as, you know, talking about child abuse. It's just, it's a crazy mixed up world, John. Crazy mixed up world.
Well, I'm sure, Ian, that one of the things that, one of the first books I read in recovery was the Big Book of AA, and there's a line in there saying is, we acknowledge we know but a little. God will reveal more to us when we are ready. And I've found that to be so true in my life when I've started to ask myself questions, and it all seems to come out.
You take care, John. I've got someone else at the door now.
We're just running up to the top of the hour. I wanted to thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for coming on this evening. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks,
and I wish you well in all your endeavours.
Yeah. God bless you, John. Take care.
God bless.
Bye.
Bye now. Bye.